Although today we don't plan to read any verses from that chapter, because we're studying the life history of King Saul versus the history of King David as an illustration of the way in which those who have once stood in the light of God's truth can bow down to the beast and his image. We're dwelling heavily upon the statement found in the Desire of Ages 3-4, where Sister White tells us that the only defense against the power of evil is the indwelling of the presence of Christ in the soul. We came last week in our study of the life of Saul to that point where at last he gave up waiting for Samuel to come and offered the sacrifice himself. We turn now to 1 Samuel chapter 13, and I'll read from Patriarchs and Prophets the scripture quoted here from that chapter, where it says, "It came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. Samuel saw at once that Saul had gone contrary to the express directions that had been given him. The Lord had spoken by his prophets that at this time he would reveal what Israel must do in this crisis. If Saul had fulfilled the conditions upon which divine help was promised, the Lord would have wrought a marvelous deliverance for Israel with the few who were loyal to the king. But Saul was so well satisfied with himself and his work that he went out to meet the prophet as one who should be commended rather than disapproved." Now last week we mentioned the fact that David had sinned because he had lost faith in God. We saw too from the word here that Saul had likewise lost faith in God and therefore had committed sin, because as Patriarchs and Prophets tells us, that every failure on the part of the children of God is due to what? Their lack of faith. Now, tragically, we have to admit that we've all made our mistakes. We have been seduced by Satan into sin. We have stumbled and we've fallen, even though God's pattern and program for us is a sinless life, because the Lord Jesus, through Paul, says to us, "Awake to righteousness and what? Sin not." Not less and less, but sin not. And while we recognize and frankly admit and see that these great men of God of the past, even after they were born again, did commit sin, not for one moment is this to be an argument that they had to commit sin, nor in any sense of the word a denial of the possibility that they could have lived a life of unblemished faith and therefore of unbroken righteousness. There are men who did. Against Enoch stands no record of sin, neither against Joseph, neither against Job. Whereas, of course, we find others who did stumble and fall, neither against Daniel, for that matter, do we find any record of unfaithfulness or of stumbling or of falling. And the lives of those men prove it could be done, and could be done to the blessing and the benefit and the betterment of those who did it too. Now, the point, however, we're concerned about today is as to why it was that when King Saul committed this sin, he found himself becoming detached from God, whereas when David committed those sins, he actually, in a sense, was drawn nearer to God. Obviously, it does not lie in the fact that these men sinned. What it does lie in is the fact of what they did about those sins when they committed them, and their attitude toward the sin when they were in the actual act of committing it. So I read further to discern just what the attitude on King Saul's part was versus the attitude a little later on David's part. "Samuel's countenance was full of anxiety and trouble, but to his inquiry, 'What hast thou done?' Saul offered excuses for his presumptuous act. He said, 'I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash. Therefore, said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering.'" Let's ponder a moment now the answer given here by the king in the first chapter, in the first book of Samuel, chapter 13. First of all, did King Saul have expressed directions from God as to what he should do? He did. Expressed directions. And those expressed directions given to him by God through his prophet was that he should wait for the Lord's prophet at Gilgal for 7 days until the prophet should come. Now, admittedly, Through God's own hand, Samuel was delayed slightly in his arrival, so the 7 days fully expired, and Samuel had not quite reached the place where King Saul was. And so Saul went ahead and disobeyed the direct act of God in doing this. Now, as he did it, as he made this direct disobedience, did Saul feel any deep convictions of sin as he carried out this action? Apparently not. Apparently not. And yet when Samuel came to him, did the expression of Samuel provide for Saul a direct message of God's attitude to Saul or towards Saul for what he'd done? Did Samuel's countenance or expression convey that? Most definitely. You know, there are some people who feel that we should not carry upon our faces a declaration of our attitude towards sin, that we should be very sweet and kind to the sinner. But Samuel wasn't back there. His face was full of anxiety and trouble. There was no smile. There was no gladsome welcome. There was no beaming approval. There was no sweet attitude of excusing what Saul had done. Remember, too, that when Sister White was called upon by God to utter against the people of her day direct and even scathing rebukes, and when she naturally, of course, found this a very distasteful task and turned aside from doing it, and envisioned Christ appeared to her, smiling, by no means. His face was so stern, his countenance so disapproving, and his action of turning his back upon her so distressing that Sister White was extremely troubled and upset by this attitude of Christ toward her. Did Christ's attitude toward her have the desired effect? Very much so, because she realized that she dared not still the pen or quiet her voice against those whom God commanded her to speak. She must faithfully carry out her work, even though this may be something very distasteful to human nature. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that we're to go around with long, stern faces all the time. There are times when kindness to the sinner is the correct attitude, but never should there be any countenance on our part to approve what the sinner does, either in their lives or our own. And so Samuel's countenance was full of anxiety and trouble. And that expression should have caused Saul right away to look at himself and say, well, now, he's God's prophet. He doesn't come to me happy and glad. He comes to me concerned and troubled. Therefore, something's wrong. Now, what is it? And when the question followed, when Samuel said, what hast thou done? Now, that didn't come as a greeting. We say to people, good morning, how are you? And that how are you is not really so much a direct concern as to how you are. It's just a kind of a regular formal greeting, isn't it? But when Samuel said to Saul, what hast thou done? Was that just a casual greeting? Was it? Absolutely not. It was a demand of inquiry. It carried in itself the inference that Saul had been doing something which he ought not to have done. When your child comes in looking rather guilty, you say, what have you been doing? Does the child know that he's on the spot? Most certainly he does. And Saul that day should have absolutely known that he was on the spot, if we can use that expression, before God in the presence of God's prophets. There was only one course of action. I should say only one correct course of action. Of course, there's more than one course of action available, but only one correct course of action open to Saul at this point of time. And that correct course of action was A, to look straight away at himself and reflect upon what he'd done and ask himself the question, did I do right or did I do wrong? That's the first thing that he rightly should have done. And when, under the convicting power of God's Spirit, he saw that he had been doing wrong, then the only wise, the only safe, the only proper thing for him to do would be to frankly say, look, Samuel, I am in the wrong. I did lose faith. I didn't wait when I should have waited. And I have taken upon myself a sacred office which God has never given to me. I have sinned and sinned very grievously before the Lord. Now, if Saul had done that, then what would his after history have been? As it was, or very different? Very different. What did Saul do? Let's see what he did. And let's read in this very carefully today a picture of an everlasting tendency in your flesh and in my flesh. And that tendency is to excuse our own actions and feel that whatever we do is right. And so I read, Saul offered excuses for his presumptuous act. He said, I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash. Now, what was Saul really saying in regard to Samuel? He was saying, it's all your fault. If you'd come on time, then this wouldn't have happened. And what is more, he was saying, it's all God's fault. Because God's let these Philistines come up here in this great mass against me, and God hasn't given the people faith to go out and fight against them, so it's all God's fault, it's all your fault, Samuel. What could you expect me to do? Now, isn't that the natural tendency of the human heart, the natural human heart, to blame everybody else but whom? Ourselves. But is there anything more disastrous than that for a human being? There isn't. The only safe course is to blame yourself where you are in the blame. To frankly and openly say, yes, I did lose faith. I didn't wait, as Saul should have done. And because I didn't have faith and because I didn't wait, I went ahead and did this thing. Now look at the next lie which comes along where it says, Therefore, said I, the Philistines will come down upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. Was this truthful? It certainly wasn't. Saul didn't force himself. He came to the place where he felt that's all he could do, and he went ahead and did it. And I think there was a measure of pride involved, and he's taking upon himself the priestly work. Now notice now the fearful word which came from that prophet to the king. And Samuel said to Saul, Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel for ever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people. And Samuel arose and gat him up from Gilgal unto Gibeah of Benjamin. In the ears of a king back in those days, there was no sentence more terrible than to be told that his children should not continue in his kingdom. That's the most terrible sentence could be ever given to a king. There was nothing those men desired more than to have a throne which should endure for how long? Forever. That's what they wanted. And to tell that king he lost that monarchy, the dynasty would now pass to another man, was something which was the greatest punishment that could be given to him. Let me read further now to see his attitude even under this rebuke. Because it's amazing how when the heart of a man becomes filled with self-sufficiency and pride, when he starts making excuses for his course of action, that man will go on and on in the most stubborn rebellion and resistance no matter what God may say to him. Either Israel must cease to be the people of God, or the principle upon which the monarchy was founded must be maintained and the nation must be governed by a divine power. If Israel would be holy of the Lord's, if the will of the human and earthly were held in subjection to the will of God, he would continue to be the ruler of Israel. So long as the king and the people would conduct themselves as subordinate to God, so long would he be their defense. But in Israel, no monarchy could prosper that did not in all things acknowledge the supreme authority of God. If Saul has shown a regard for the requirements of God in this time of trial, God could have worked his will through him. His faith now proved him unfit to be the vicegerent of God to his people. He would mislead Israel. His will, rather than the will of God, would be the controlling power. If Saul had been faithful, his kingdom would have been established forever. But since he had failed, the purpose of God must be accomplished by another. The government of Israel would be committed to one who would rule the people according to the will of heaven. Now let's consider something of the price that King Saul paid. Now, obedience to God will always cost us a price. Always. Is there any exception to this? There's no exception. It will always cost us a price. Now, these are the prices to be paid. And mark this point with care, disobedience also costs us a price. Is that right? Both ways. And the question remains before us as to which of these two costs we are going to be prepared to bear. Now, if Saul had made his confession, Let's see what it would have cost him. The cost of his pride? Absolutely. Would it have cost him his self-will? Right. It would have cost him his self-will. And those two things in particular. Because he would have had to make a confession in which he openly and frankly stated before God, the prophet, and the people that he had been in the wrong. Now, let's see now. Now, this is what it actually would have cost him. That. Let's put below that what, in addition to that, he thought it would have cost him. Now, he felt that it would have cost him the respect of whom? Right? The people. And if it cost him the respect of the people, then what about his authority? Right? Now, if he lost his authority, what would he lose then? Good. His kingdom. Now, Satan said, if you confess, if you surrender your pride and self-will, you're going to lose the respect of the people. Therefore, you'll lose your authority and you will lose your kingdom. Was that a high price to pay? It certainly was. Was Saul prepared to pay it? No, he wasn't. So Saul proposed to preserve his respect, or the respect of the people, I should say, and his authority and his kingdom by preserving his pride and self-will and by refusing to confess. You know that text in Matthew, I think chapter 16, where Jesus said, if any man will seek to save his life, what will happen? He'll lose it. If any man will lose his life for my sake, then what? He will save it unto life eternal. Now, I want you now to see that the very thing that Saul tried to save, he lost. Whereas if he's prepared to lose that, to do the right thing, then he would have saved the very thing that he did try to save by the wrong method. Respect. That's the point I'm coming to. That's absolutely, absolutely right in this case. They would have respected him far more. Because a little further on in the story, you remember how that when Samuel left Saul at this point, and Saul withdrew to Gibeah, as we just read a moment ago, and hid himself, and Jonathan, his armor-bearer, went up, and the two of them alone routed the entire Philistine host because of God's power. And then, as you remember, Jonathan unwittingly partook of some honey during the flight of the Philistines, or the pursuit of the Philistines, after King Saul had rashly said no one was to eat until the victory was done. And then the king desired to kill his son. And the people saw with trembling hearts the kind of king they had, and Sister White says here somewhere that never again could they have real confidence in that king. They had doubts and fears as to his real intentions and so forth. I'll come to that. Well, maybe I should just find that particular statement right now so that we can just read it. Yes, his wrong sense of value, yes. Page 626. Had not the men of Israel interposed to save the life of Jonathan, their deliverer would have perished by the king's decree. With what misgivings must that people afterwards have followed Saul's guidance? And when you have misgivings, is that respect and confidence? It's not, is it? How bitter the thought that he had been placed upon the throne by their own act. The Lord bears long with the waywardness of men, and to all he grants opportunity to see and forsake their sins. But while he may seem to prosper those who disregard his will and despise his warnings, he will in his own time surely make manifest their folly. So then, what Saul had to surrender was his pride and self-will, and what he appeared therefore to lose was respect to the people, his authority, and his kingdom. Now when Samuel came to him, as I read to you there a moment ago, Samuel said, because you have done this, you are going to lose your kingdom, and therefore your authority, and therefore the respect of the people. That was the price which he paid by keeping his pride and his self-will. Now, on the other side, if he had surrendered his pride and self-will, then he would have retained the respect of the people, retained his authority as never before, and he would have retained his kingdom as never before. When David later sinned against Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, Patriarchs and Prophets tells us when he made his confession before God, he wrote a psalm about that confession, and then he led all Israel to sing that psalm of confession with him. By so doing, what did he do but endear himself to his kingdom? Didn't he? Endeared himself to the kingdom, and Saul could have done the same thing. Now, let's go just back to the Bible commentary. Now, there's some very, very fine statements here which are of great value in our study at the moment. This is page 1014 of volume 2. The statement came from the youth instructor on November 17, 1898. In detaining Samuel, it was the purpose of God that the heart of Saul should be revealed, that others might know what he would do in an emergency. Now, we want to realize that every day those of us who are in the school of Christ are being tested and proved to see just what we're made of. And we should regard every day's activities as being very, very solemn. The attitude that we bear, the words we let drop from our lips, the things that we carry out and do from time to time are revealing before men and angels just what kind of people we really are. So I read further, it was a trying position in which to be placed, but Saul did not obey orders. He felt that it would make no difference who approached God or in what way, and full of energy and self-complacency, he put himself forward into the sacred office. The Lord has his appointed agencies, and if these are not discerned and respected by those who are connected with his work, if men feel free to disregard God's requirements, they must not be kept in positions of trust. They would not listen to counsel nor to the commands of God through his appointed agencies. Like Saul, they would rush into a work that was never appointed them, and the mistakes they would make in following their human judgment would place the Israel of God where their leader could not reveal himself to them. Sacred things would become mingled with the common. Now read again from the same review and held, used to stretch a little further down the same page. Saul could have offered humble prayer to God without the sacrifice, for the Lord will accept even the silent petitions of a heart, a burdened heart, but instead of this he forced himself into the priesthood. Now another statement from the Signs of the Times, August 10, 1882. Saul endeavored to vindicate his own course and blame the prophet instead of condemning himself. What a tragedy. Was the prophet to blame? No, he'd obeyed God implicitly. Was Saul to blame? Yes, he had disobeyed God explicitly. And the disobedient are the ones to blame, not the obedient. There are today many who pursue a similar course. Like Saul, they are blinded to their errors. When the Lord seeks to correct them, they receive reproof as insult and find fault with the one who brings the divine message. That's a very important paragraph, I do feel. Like Saul, they are blinded to their errors. And this is a great tragedy when you find the person who has willfully continued in the course of error and have refused to examine their own hearts, they become blinded to their own errors, and in their own eyes, what are they? Righteous, unimpeachable, in any sense of the word at all. And when the Lord seeks to correct them, not men, but the Lord seeks to correct them, they receive reproof as insult and find fault with the one who brings a divine message. Remember very distinctly back in California a number of years ago, there was a brother there who was pursuing a course that was manifestly out of tune with the work of God. The time came when a question arose in the meeting which dealt directly on the subject, and I took out the Word of God and just simply read to the people there in that meeting what the Word of God itself said and nothing else but that. And that person hated me personally for doing that, whereas he ought to have recognized his real enmity was not against me but against the Word. But this is the pattern which happens again and again. I read further, had Saul been willing to see and confess his error, this bitter experience would have proved a safeguard for the future. Now, do you recall that when we read the life story of David during the camp meeting and we found that David too made his mistakes, that what did those mistakes provide David? A safeguard for the future, because he learnt by those mistakes not to repeat them in the future. But when Saul refused to learn, then of course he had no safeguard for the future and what therefore happened in the future. Same thing all over again. And note the wording very carefully. Had Saul been willing to see, even though he was blinded by his errors, if he'd been willing to see, if he'd said to himself in December, well, I can't see my problem, but I'm willing to be shown, what then? We read it here. This bitter experience would have proved a safeguard for the future. He would afterwards have avoided the mistakes which call forth divine reproof. But feeling that he was unjustly condemned, he would, of course, be likely again to commit the same sin. The Lord would have his people under all circumstances manifest implicit trust in him. Although we cannot always understand the workings of his providences, we should wait with patience and humility until he sees fit to enlighten us. We should beware of taking upon ourselves responsibility which God has not authorized us to bear. Men frequently have too high an estimate of their own character or abilities. They may feel competent to undertake the most important work when God sees that they are not prepared to perform aright the smallest and humblest duty. And so the Signs of the Times, August 10, 1882. Now go to another statement from the Signs of the Times, August 3, a week earlier. Saul's transgression proved him unworthy to be entrusted with sacred responsibilities. One who had himself so little reverence for God's requirements could not be a wise or a safe leader for the nation. Had he patiently endured the divine test, the crown would have been confirmed to him and to his house. In fact, Samuel had come to Gilgal for this very purpose, but Saul had been weighed in the balance and found wanting. He must be removed to make way for one who would sacredly regard the divine honor and authority. Now, of course, you recognize that years and years passed before this substitution took place, during which time, of course, Israel had ample time to reflect upon the mistake they made in asking for a king. So there is the tragic picture of Samuel coming down to Gilgal for the express purpose of making permanent the appointment of Saul to the kingship of Israel. Permanent in the sense that his son and son's sons and son's sons to many, many generations, or eternal generations, should be kings upon the throne of Israel. David followed Saul. He proved himself faithful, and to him was given the honor of a permanent kingship, which of course is made eternally permanent in the fact that Jesus Christ is the son of David and will reign forever upon the throne of David. Now I read this solemn thought from Patriarchs and Prophets 6:21 and 6:22. We do not know what great interests may be at stake in the proving of God. There is no safety except in strict obedience to the word of God. All his promises are made upon condition of faith and obedience, and the failure to comply with his commands cuts off the fulfillment to us of the rich provisions of the scriptures. We should not follow impulse, nor rely upon the judgment of men. We should look to the revealed will of God and walk according to his definite commandment, no matter what circumstances may surround us. God will take care of the results. By faithfulness to his word, we may in time of trial prove before men and angels that the Lord can trust us in difficult places to carry out his will, honor his name, and bless his people. This makes things rather simple, doesn't it? It means that when we come down to difficult circumstances, we're not to stay in those circumstances. They don't bear upon the matter at all. We are to ask ourselves only one question: what has God commanded me to do in this particular situation? And when we read the command of God and know what God has commanded, then obey that, because God will take care of the results. Now we know, of course, that Satan complicates circumstances. He makes them appear to be so confused. He makes them appear to be so entangled and reaching out to involve other lives that we feel that we just can't do this because it's going to affect somebody else or bring about undesired results. But are we to worry about the results? No, we're not. We have to worry about what has God commanded in this particular situation. And if we shall obey that command, a definite specific command, then who will take care of the results? God will. Is he reliable to do this? Why, certainly. As we shall see, we continue this in next week's study, that while Saul looked upon the circumstances around him and felt the case was lost and the battle couldn't be won with such a tiny handful of men, God said, I'll show you what can be done with a tiny handful of men, and sent two God-fearing youth, Jonathan his armor-bearer, up the mountain where the Philistines were in Michmash, and those two men did, under God's power, what Saul desired to do through a complete army. What Saul felt he needed 100,000 men to do, two men did with God's power and routed the entire Philistine host. Let's then learn from the lessons of David and King Saul, because these things are written for our learning upon whom the ends of the world are come. Let's rise to that great height of human greatness, divine greatness, where we come to the place where we're able to candidly, honestly, and frankly confess the wrong when we've done the wrong. And making an honest and candid confession, then we're in the position where God can work and mightily deliver us from the power of the enemy who comes against us. The fact that we sin is serious enough, but far more serious is what we do about that sin after we have committed it. May God bless us each one to do the right thing at all times is my prayer today.